We might expect Francis Bacon to fit easily into this series on cultures of knowledge in early modern Europe. He was, after all, one of the most visible intellectuals of British life in the Jacobean era, an icon for the Royal Society during the Restoration, and a name frequently dropped in the works of continental philosophers and scientists throughout the 17th century and beyond. And yet those reading Bacon's letters for his scholarly correspondence, or for his involvement in international networks of learned men, will be sorely disappointed. In the 19th century, James Spedding printed 7 volumes of Bacon's letters, and yet almost none of the 800-plus letters mention his intellectual work, bearing witness instead to his busy political, parliamentary, and above all legal careers. If you were to write a biography of Francis Bacon based on the archival epistolary evidence, you would produce less a high-minded account of the advancement of learning and more a worldly and slightly sordid narrative of the social advancement of Francis Bacon. And don't bother writing it, because I did. And it's that was what we did. That's what we produced. Spedding prints one late letter from Bacon to Fulgencio Micanzio in Venice, in which Bacon does describe the immensity of his intellectual project. But that's it. There's no correspondence with Galileo or Kepler or Grotius or Peiresque or any other of the continental intellectuals with whom one might well expect Bacon to correspond. How can we account for this absence? It could be argued, of course, that the letters have simply been lost, but this seems unlikely. Bacon was a famous man in his lifetime, pretty much throughout his lifetime, and many of his letters were carefully collected, copied, and circulated. It seems unlikely that a huge amount of material has been somehow accidentally missed. The major archives in France and Italy have been well studied by other scholars, and with Patricia Brewerton and Andrew Gordon, I undertook a thorough trawl of the British and North American archives 8 to 10 years ago, the calendar of correspondence that Rodri mentioned, and came up with just more of the same stuff that Spedding prints. It may be that Bacon didn't like to share his ideas in this form. Spedding chose not to print one letter from Thomas Bodley, which survives in multiple copies in manuscript. Bodley had been sent the Cogitata et Visa to read in manuscript. He wrote to tell Bacon he'd be better off not showing it to anyone else. Which basically said, this is not your thing. Drop it. We may have to conclude with regret that Bacon simply chose not to enter into the Republic of Letters. I don't know the answer. But what I want to explore this afternoon is one way in which Bacon might have understood the world of letters, by which I mean epistolary correspondence, as a result of his own experience in the early years of his career. I shall suggest that Bacon was both intensely knowledgeable and intensely wary of what a letter could accomplish and how complex the letter form could be. For from 1588 to 1601, Bacon was immersed in a very particular world of letters, a world in which letters operated in a manner far removed from our modern understanding. Now, the work in this paper is very much in dialogue with several recent contributions to the field, which I'll acknowledge at the outset. And if you were reading a version of this, they would be running through the footnotes. First, Paul Hammer's invaluable research on Robert Devereux, the second Earl of Essex, and the Essex Circle, which is transforming our understanding of this crucial figure in late Elizabethan politics. Second, recent work on letters and letter writing, most notably Andrew Gordon's work on Bacon and Essex, the first fruits of which appeared in English literary Renaissance. I keep doing that. You move to America and you lose the ability to pronounce basic English words. English literary Renaissance in 2007, an article called A Fortune of Papal Walls, The Letters of Francis Bacon and the Earl of Essex. And also James Daybell's work on Tudor letter writing in general, and in particular his forthcoming work on the scribal publication of Lady Rich's letter to Elizabeth I. So there's a group of people, I think, all talking in slightly different ways about this issue of letters as they relate to the Earl of Essex and his circle. From around 1588, Francis Bacon, then an up-and-coming Gray's Inn lawyer and junior parliamentarian, became associated with Robert Devereux, the second Earl of Essex. While his elder brother, Anthony Bacon, clearly became a follower of the Earl for some year living in Essex's own house, Francis Bacon was something between a client and a friend. The Earl acted as a patron for Bacon, attempting to secure him the posts of Attorney General and Solicitor General, both in vain, while Bacon undertook a variety of duties for the Earl, most notably offering him counsel in the latter part of the 1590s through a series of widely circulated letters. In the 18th and 19th centuries, however, Bacon's involvement with in the Earl's life came to be regarded as more thoroughgoing. Two important editors of Bacon's work, Thomas Birch in the 1760s and James Spedding in the 1860s, identified various writings previously attributed to the Earl of Essex as being the work of Francis Bacon. These included a device written for the 1595 Accession Day celebrations, but I'm more concerned today with several letters claimed by Spedding for Bacon, letters of advice sent under Essex's name and signature, one to Fulke Greville and three to Roger Manners, the young 5th Earl of Rutland. Since the 1860s, when Spedding published these as Bacon's in Volume 2 of the Letters and Life, scholars have been generally happy to write about these work as Bacon's, identifying continuities in theme, content and style between these late Elizabethan writings and Bacon's later, more significant publications, such as The Advancement of Learning, The Essays and The New Atlantis. But then, in a series of articles published from 1994, Paul Hammer, the leading expert on Essex, took issue with this attribution of authorship to Bacon. Hammer showed that Essex was building a team of secretaries to compete with the secretariat of the father and son team of the Cecils in order to establish himself as a natural successor to Burleigh as Elizabeth's leading counsellor. Unlike Burleigh, however, Hammer argues, Essex had great faith in the practical value of academic learning, and his impressive secretarial pool included scholars including Thomas Smith, Edward Reynolds, Henry Wotton, Edward Jones, and even the Regius Professor of Greek at Oxford, Henry Cuff, who was lured away from the university for a salary of £20 per annum, which can still happen, I think. In addition to these paid secretaries, Essex had an array of scholarly friends on whom he called for some quasi-secretarial duties, including Anthony and Francis Bacon. Hammer speaks of various writings, and now we see if this works, as the product of a cooperative effort between Essex, his secretaries, and perhaps Francis Bacon, with Essex at the helm. Essex himself had a major part in composing these productions, but he also used the assistance of his secretariat, and possibly also of Francis Bacon. So you can see from these, the way he phrases this, in Hammer's account, these men worked in a scholarly collaboration in which Essex remained the dominant factor. The works are commissioned by him, bearing his name and his imprimatur. And Bacon's involved, but it's a sort of and perhaps, and possibly also. Hammer's assertions provoked a spirited response from Bacon specialist Brian Vickers, who argues that the various devices and letters of advice were interlinked in many ways, mirroring the development of Bacon's thought in the 1590s and reflecting characteristic methods of composition. In Vickers' model, Essex seems to have called on Francis Bacon's help when he needed some particularly delicate piece of writing, such as an eloquent or tactful composition involving the Queen. Vickers concludes, instead of Paul Hammer's image of Bacon as a subsidiary helper in Essex's campaign of reinstatement, grudgingly admitted to the same level as the men in Essex's employ, I should like to propose a different scenario. Bacon, already an experienced lawyer and politician, expending much energy between 1595 and 1600 as a private counsellor. And this debate has gone backwards and forwards over the decade or so after 1994. What's important to note here is that Hammer and Vickers in fact share an understanding of a working relationship between Essex and Bacon, whereby Bacon would draft written materials for Essex's use. The difference between them, it seems, lies in attribution, the relative credit for authorship that each should receive. My understanding in this paper is that both Hammer and Vickers are absolutely right in their assertions. That's my way out of a sticky situation. That these works circulated as Essex's and were composed by Bacon. What I find interesting is how they can both be right at the same time and what that means. For while we might be quite happy to acknowledge that a leading courtier and politician like Essex might use ghostwriters to prepare position papers or speeches, it seems more of a stretch to claim that he might use someone else to write his personal letters. Letters, after all, are one of the most personal forms of communication, sent in their most common form from one individual to another individual. We're the inheritors of a letter-writing tradition that moves from Cicero to Petrarch to Erasmus, who most famously promulgated a working definition of the letter as a conversation between two absent persons, arguing that the letter differs hardly at all from the ordinary speech of everyday conversation. That's Erasmus. It's especially easy for us to accept Erasmus's definitions. We, after all, tend to write our letters in private, send and receive letters through an anonymous postal service, and then read them in private. But Erasmus's definition was disingenuously masking the realities of early modern epistolary communication, in which letters were often not written alone, were often carried from sender to recipient by a personalised bearer, and were often read aloud in company. As we'll see, when Essex wrote to Greville or Rutland, he was certainly not doing it alone. So today I'm going to focus on who writes Essex's letters in the 1590s and why. In 1604, Bacon recalled how he had served the Earl of Essex. "It is well known how I did many years since dedicate my travels and studies to the use, and as I may term it, service of my Lord of Essex, which I protest before God I did not, making election of him as the likeliest mean of mine own advancement, but because I held at that time my Lord to be the fittest instrument to do good to the state, and therefore I applied myself to him in a manner which I think happeneth rarely amongst men. For I did not only labour carefully and industriously in that he set me about, whether it were matter of advice or otherwise, but neglecting the Queen's service, mine own fortune, and in a sort my vocation, I did nothing but devise and ruminate with myself, to the best of my understanding, propositions and memorials of anything that might concern his lordship's honour, fortune, or service." So that's what he writes in 1604. These words come at the beginning of Bacon's apology in Certain Imputations Concerning the Earl of Essex, his attempt to explain his apparent abandonment and prosecution of the Earl following a lengthy and close relationship as his advisor. As Essex fell out of favour with Elizabeth, he was twice tried, the first time for deserting his post in Ireland and other misdemeanours during his campaign there. He was tried at York House in 1600, and then after his attempted rebellion in February 1601, he was tried again. And the prosecutor, on both those occasions, one of the prosecutors was Francis Bacon. So you have this situation where a man who was one of his closest friends is now his prosecutor in court, and Bacon found that something he had to explain once Essex's reputation was rehabilitated in 1603. In the apology, Bacon represents his counsel to Essex as coming largely in the form of propositions and memorials, as he says here, or formal letters of advice upon particular occasions, and some of those have survived. But much more of Bacon's counsel came in more collaborative forms. Early in the 1590s, we find Bacon advising Essex on what to write. Thanks to the work of Anthony Grafton, Lisa Jardine, and others, we're now attuned to the concept of the scholarly reader who studied for action, the classic case study being Cambridge fellow Gabriel Harvey, who reads Livy with the likes of Philip Sidney and Thomas Smith in order to glean advice on present political situations from Livy's examples. Bacon, it seems, worked in a similar way, not only with reading, but with writing, guiding the writing of Essex's letters. I'll turn first to an undated letter, probably 1593, from Essex to Bacon, which is now Lambeth Palace Library. In it, Essex explains that he is under pressure from the Queen to produce, at short notice, a draft of an instruction on intelligence concerning Reims and Rome, both of them home to English seminaries. The premise of this demand is that Elizabeth intends to send one of her Privy Council on a mission, but Essex doubts this is actually the case. Instead, he says, "The Queen doth it rather to try my judgment in it." In other words, the writing he's been asked to produce is a test of his capabilities. I think this is just after he's been appointed to the Privy Council. Faced with this challenge, however, Essex does not sit down and write a tract himself. Instead, he seeks out the expertise of two men: Thomas Phillips, a noted cryptographer who worked closely with the late Secretary of State Francis Walsingham, and Francis Bacon. So this is what Essex writes to Bacon. "Master Phillips hath known Master Secretary's courses in such matters, so as I may have counsel from you and precedence from him. I pray you, as your leisure will serve, and send me your conceit as soon as you can, for I know not how soon I shall be called on. I will draw some notes of mine own, which I will reform and enlarge by yours." So Phillips will provide precedence based on the kind of thing that's been done in the past. Bacon will supply counsel in the form of written notes. Essex will then reform and enlarge his own draft, incorporating anything useful from Bacon's. Now here the work clearly stands as Essex's. The Earl here commissions the piece, suggests the mechanism for its composition, perhaps, although it's not clear, polishes the final product himself, presents it to the Queen himself, takes credit for it. It's the kind of process that Hammer envisions, with Bacon providing only part of the process and Essex in control. The relative importance, though, of the collaborators' contributions was often more difficult to judge. We can see this in the production of what was meant to be a newsletter relaying news of Essex's sacking of Cadiz in June of 1596. Bacon's not involved in this, but I like this example so much that I think I want to use it. Needing to publicise his success back in England, there's no point in sacking Cadiz if no one in England knows about it. Essex dispatched his secretary, Henry Cuff, armed with Essex eulogising accounts of the victory, to oversee their publication in print. But Cuff fell ill en route, and so he was obliged to send the materials on to another Essex secretary back in England, Edward Reynolds, with a covering letter which provides a rare and detailed glimpse into the mechanics of manuscript production. So basically he says, he explains how this thing was written that he's sending on and what has to happen to it when it gets into print. The content of the second letter's second half is familiar enough to anyone who reads early modern printed books, with their conventional apologetics for how things accidentally got into print. Cuff asks Reynolds to replace his preface, if he considers it necessary, write a better one, and prefix it to the account so that the tract would appear to be a letter sent from Cadiz to a gentleman in court back from England. So they're trying to obscure where this came from. The publication should then take place under someone's initials, with that person claiming that they received the discourse from Cadiz from, say, DT, as the one he suggests, but they don't actually know who DT is. Cuff suggests that they use the initials of either Essex's friend at court, Fulke Greville, or Privy Council clerk, Robert Beale, as the person who is receiving the letter. Like, we don't involve them, but we just use their initials. These are all ploys familiar from print culture. But Cuff's letter also tells us much of the often hidden processes by which a commissioned discourse or speech or letter came to be written. The discourse, he writes, was penned very truly according to his lordship's large instructions, physically written by Cuff, following general instructions from Essex, also drawing on Cuff's own knowledge, by which, besides my own knowledge, he informed me of sundry particulars of moment in the process thereof. And after I had penned it, written it out, as plainly as I might, altering little or nothing of his own draft, I caused his lordship to peruse it once again, and to add extremum manum, the final hand, the last hand, which he hath done, as you may perceive by the interlining. So it's Cuff's handwriting, double-spaced, as it were, with Essex's annotations in the middle. This is what the letter looks like at this point. His lordship's purpose is that it should with the soonest be set in print, both to stop all vagrant rumours and to enforce those that are well affected of the truth of the whole. Yet so that in case neither his lordship's name nor mine, nor any other my lord, be either openly named, used, or so insinuated, that any slender guess may be drawn who was the penman. We need to make sure that none of us are implicated in this. Not Essex, not me, Henry Cuff, no, none of our friends. My opinion is that the best course is presently to cause a fair transcript to be made, write it out again, neatly, and so either by Master Temple or some other less to be suspected, in which point I know Sir Anthony Ashley will most willingly lend you his helping hand, to cause it to be delivered to some good printer in good characters and with diligence to publish it. So the fair transcript needs to be made by someone unlikely to be suspected. He proposes William Temple, who's also one of Essex's team. But maybe he's a bit too close. Sir Anthony Ashley, he's a Privy Council clerk serving as Secretary of War for the Cadiz mission. He's recently been knighted by Essex, so he's probably a good person to ask to do something right now. And then they cause it to be delivered to a printer. Of course, what's happening here is that it's deliberately made impossible to track this to any particular writer. Is the letter Essex's or Cuff's or Reynolds or the man who will provide the fair transcript, or so Temple or Ashley? Even if it could be linked to any of them, it's going to be published under other sets of initials, DT and maybe Fulke Greville or Robert Beale. What's happening here is the aim is to distract attention from the author to produce an effect of anonymity. Now, each of these cases seems to have Essex calling the shots, at least from the beginning. It's he who sets the work in action. But this was not always the case, as I shall show. The Gibson papers at Lambeth Palace Library hold a tract that's docketed in Bacon's hand, a letter framed for my Lord of Essex to the Queen. Here Bacon does not take on the Earl's own voice, not quite, but he certainly walks him sentence by sentence through a letter that he should write. That you desire Her Majesty to believe that it is not conscience to yourself of any advantage Her Majesty hath towards you, nor any drift or device to win Her Majesty by to any point or particular that moveth you to send her these lines of your own mind. So all Essex has to do is change some of the pronouns and say, I desire Your Majesty to believe that it's not conscience to myself of any advantage Your Majesty hath towards me, nor any drift or device to win Your Majesty that moveth me to send these lines of my own mind. And I quite like the idea that Bacon's actually making Essex write these lines of my own mind, which we clearly aren't. What we have to remember here is that men like Henry Cuff, Henry Savile, Francis Bacon did not work for Essex simply to take dictation. They were scholars and intellectuals with their own often strongly held beliefs and opinions. They entered into the service of a powerful politician precisely so that their voices might be heard through the man they served. And it's this dynamic we see at work in the Essex letters that Spedding claimed as for Bacon. Letters of advice, one to Fulke Greville and three to Roger Manners, the Earl of Rutland. And I want to spend the rest of the paper talking about these. In the letter to Greville, which I've dated to 1589, Essex advises his cousin Fulke, they were kinsmen, on scholarly matters, on the occasion of Greville's journey to Cambridge, where he was going to recruit one scholar to work in his household and hire two or three more to work for him in the university. The letter is centrally concerned with the way in which these gatherers, men that shall out of their own reading gather for the use of another, should work. It advised the gathering of materials by epitome or abridgment or under heads and commonplaces, and says, although there are printed epitomes available in most subjects, the letter disparages them and claims that epitomes must be made anew from their original sources. So it's how to, it's getting these men to do original research for you. Preferable to epitomes, however, are the collections under heads and commonplaces, because they possess a kind of observation through the arrangement of materials into headings. A life of Alexander the Great, for example, drawn from the writings of Curtius or Plutarch, will yield insights into such topics as the phenomenon of the conqueror or war and periods of or revolutions of state, if you arrange your note-taking that way. It gives advice on the choice of the headings, the books out of which notes should be taken, and the way and the notes that should be set down. The letter rejects standard commonplace in categories and urges the taking of special advice before settling on only a few. So it's very much directed note-taking. Among the choice of books, the letter stresses histories above all, naming Demosthenes, Cicero, Tacitus, Livy, and Thucydides. It utterly rejects poetry as a useful thing. The notes should be in the categories of natural, moral, politic, or military. Finally, the writer exhorts Greville to be the master workman yourself, and to gather the chiefest things and out of the chiefest books yourself, using the other collectors like labourers to bring stone, timber, mortar, and other necessaries to your building in gathering arguments and examples to prove or illustrate any particular position or question. Now, as Spedding realised, and many critics since have elaborated, that description is full of things that sound like Francis Bacon. For anyone who's read The Advancement of Learning, this would seem to be an early draft of various stages. Bacon's attack on epitomes is very similarly phrased in The Advancement of Learning. His use of gatherers is echoed as late as the 1620s, when in the New Atlantis he gives a description of a particular sort of scholar who would be the people that go through existing printed research to bring useful things in. He calls them their depredators, which is a word I like, but gatherers here. And the master workman metaphor, where Essex exhorts Greville to be the master workman, sounds like something that Bacon is said to have complained about. William Rawley, his editor, says, I have heard his lordship speak complainingly that his lordship, who thinketh he deserveth to be an architect in this building, should be forced to be a workman and a labourer. So obviously Bacon changed his mind over the years and doesn't want to do any of it himself, but it's the same metaphor. if you don't believe it on that one, the first letter to the Earl of Rutland, I think, is the strongest case. The Earl of Rutland was about to head off to Europe in 1595. There are three letters written to him from Essex. And some have designated the travel advice, the first letter, as a formula letter. But this is to miss the point of the way the genre works. The author writes a travel advice letter to demonstrate his particular approach to the subject. And the specific nature of Essex's letter to Rutland can perhaps best be seen through comparison with a predecessor. It's been suggested that in this letter, Essex is deliberately echoing his rival Burleigh, who had in late 1570 written a letter of advice to a previous young Earl of Rutland, his ward, the Edward III Earl, who was also about to travel to France. If, as Paul Hammer has argued, Essex was keen to prove his intellectual credentials in opposition to Burleigh, then writing a letter to the next generation's young Earl of Rutland, he's the nephew of the third Earl, implicitly casts Essex as the new Burleigh, inviting comparisons between the two documents and the two authors, and containing an implicit public challenge to the old Lord Treasurer. If you look at the two letters against each other, they're completely different. Burleigh's letter to Rutland starts with a call for piety, reflects Burleigh's own fascination with nobility, as Rutland is urged to focus on the French court, the royal and aristocratic families, noble households, and genealogies. The advice is also designed to integrate Rutland into a particular kind of service. The Earl's observations on court life and military techniques, relayed back in letters, served as intelligence for a network involving Burleigh, Leicester and Sussex, Sir Francis Walsingham, and Rutland's uncle Roger Manners. So that's the Burleigh Manners letter. By contrast, Essex's letter to the next Earl of Rutland insists that the purpose of travel be subordinated to the central concern, which is to make yourself an excellent man. It sketches how one must practice cultura animi, the tilling or manuring of your own mind, to enhance its beauty, health and strength. Beauty of mind is achieved by making the mind itself excellent, and through imitation of others, and therefore the careful selection of those with whom you converse. Health of mind is attained by guarding against the passions of the mind one is apt to fall into. Strength of mind, which cannot be obtained by any industry if it is not naturally budding, must be ripened by clearness of judgment and custom of well-doing. Only once this framework is in place does the letter move on to consider what helps your travel may give you. One must choose and imitate the best among the infinite variety of behaviours and manners of men one encounters, learn how to react to passions stirred in you which before you have never felt, and confirm your natural courage when you come into contact with anything of the wars, which is recommended. Lastly, travel will provide great helps to attain to knowledge, which is not only the excellentest thing in man, but the very excellency of man. Since without knowledge there can be no fortitude, liberality, justice, constancy or patience, temperance, and no true religion. Leaving to one side the huge task to reckon up all parts of knowledge and to show the ways to attain to every part, the letter focuses on the knowledge Rutland should have desire to seek and shall have helps to compass, leaving aside also consideration of divine knowledge. After a digression explaining the importance of learning to the state, Essex outlines how Rutland should seek knowledge by study, conference, and observation. Study means by your private study, which will best be achieved not by changing location too often, and by the proper choice of books. Starting with the liberal arts and not spending too much time in studies of delights, Rutland should become conversant in the histories for moral, politic, and military instruction. He should employ someone to read with him, either taking over with you some good general scholar or seeking the expertise of professors in European universities. He should use writing or meditation or both, taking notes or abridgments of his reading, use conference with excellent men of varying opinions and different specialities. And crucially, he should make use of observation, noting the coherence of causes, effects, counsels, and successes, the end being not ostentation or ability to discourse, the mistake that many noblemen and gentlemen make, but rather the true end of knowledge, clearness and strength of judgment. There is almost no advice given in the letter to Rutland that is pertinent to travel. It's about knowledge. It's sort of on the occasion of this, here is my knowledge thing. Beyond that, counsel to employ a scholar as a reading companion and a fleeting injunction to seek out the wars. This letter is in fact an encomium to knowledge dressed up as a travel advice letter. Or put more directly, this is an expression of Bacon's analysis of knowledge that would be expanded into the advancement of learning in 1605. And indeed, in this short tract, there are no fewer than 11 clear and precise parallels to the advancement of learning. This is, I think, the most obvious. The kind of clusters of metaphors and languages and ideas are pretty much just taken out of one and put into another. Intriguingly, in its closing sentences, the text reveals signs of perhaps having been shoehorned into its present letter format, reaching an abrupt transition. I will here cut off, for I find I have both exceeded the convenient length of a letter, which it's meant to be, and come short of such a discourse as this subject doth deserve. There it is. And the piece is indeed too long to fit into the standard bifolium letter format. It goes way over what would be usually required. Interestingly, the two other letters to Rutland are far more specific to the occasion of his travel. The third letter, written on the eve of his departure, gives instructions on how to take notes on what he sees and how to organise them. The second letter has always proved more of a problem. Spedding printed a letter, which he thought probably wasn't the second letter, and indeed most scholars now believe that to be the work of Fulke Greville, and to date from 1609. However, in the course of my work on the first volume of the Oxford Francis Bacon, I've identified what I believe to be the missing second letter from a copy in the Huntington Library. And it's basically a reading list for the Earl, but it's very specific. Rutland was, by all accounts, no scholar, despite his MA from Cambridge. Not the brightest man. And Bacon seems to have tailored a reading list to his limitations. There's nothing wrong with an MA from Cambridge. Snickering. I'm sure I had to send off a stamped address envelope or something to get it. The writer suggests that the reading in logic and rhetoric be carried out by a professional reader who will prepare a logic crib based on Aristotle. It's like, don't try Aristotle, we'll get someone to prepare something for you. He counsels some reading in Spanish, but it's Montemayor's Diana. Italian, Guicciardinian Tasso, and French, Amiot's Plutarch and Comines. And he says it's, if you read Plutarch in French, you get Plutarch and you get French. It's going to be very useful for you. He also recommends a series of histories. Machiavelli, Herodians, Caesar, Sallust, Tacitus, Livy, Thucydides, which would appear to be the standard list of Italian, Latin, and Greek classics. But I think it's actually a very specific list. By 1595, when this letter was written, these were all available in English translation, printed English translation. Machiavelli is that year. There's nothing on here which is not in a modern vernacular language, in other words. And I think that's what he was doing. The letter's opening words are this. No man can give another good directions in the choice of books or seeking of knowledge that weigheth not what knowledge he whom he counselleth hath already. It's as if the writer was holding off on particular direction in the first letter because he had not yet assessed the recipient's level of knowledge. In other words, the second letter is a syllabus tailored to the strengths and, more importantly, the weaknesses of the Earl of Rutland. But despite the specificity to Rutland of the second and third letters, the first letter is, as I've said, Bacon's advancement of learning. The model here, then, is one of Bacon using his position with Essex to forward his own ideas, which will then go out into the world bearing Essex's signature. The letter was never intended to be private. It would appear from its widespread survival in over 20 manuscript copies that Essex allowed it to circulate. And there is also evidence that Rutland made its existence known. On arriving in Europe, Rutland was met at Flushing by Sir Robert Sidney, who accompanied him to The Hague. On the 6th of November, 1595, Sidney wrote to Essex, mentioning Rutland and saying, I hope he will do exceedingly well, and the more if you follow your instructions, which he did the honour to show me. From Sidney's wording, it appears that these instructions by Essex were personal letters of advice rather than more formal diplomatic instructions. They may well have included this letter. This letter supports Hammer's claim that the advice to Rutland is intended to promulgate a particular image of Essex. Rutland is clearly eager to show it to leading figures on his travels and to advertise it as the work of the Earl. But equally, it allows Bacon's ideas to have a wider circulation. It might be objected that I'm paying a lot of attention to short letter items written by Essex, or having bearing Essex's signature, when Bacon in the 1580s and early 1590s wrote lengthy pieces of his own on the controversies of the Church of England, which is about the Marprelate affair, and on Catholic libels against Burley. Those works indeed reveal Bacon's characteristics, ways of reading and use of quotation, but those major works are absolutely occasional. They're simply about these things he was responding to. It's these letters signed by and sent from Essex that contain more of Bacon's long-term intellectual project in the period to 1596, which is what I'm currently working on. Not only more than any letter signed by Francis Bacon, but more than any work written by Francis Bacon. So it's I'm in a very strange position here, saying these are the most important Bacon things and they're by somebody else. How do you do that? I want to finish by considering a situation which I think throws some light on the problems of this setup for Bacon and for Essex. The situation allows Bacon's work to reach a certain readership, if not necessarily with Bacon's name on it. But the situation did not always work in Bacon's favour. I'll end by examining the most infamous example of Bacon's ghostwriting for Essex, which was raised by the Earl himself at his trial for treason following his failed uprising in London on the 8th of February 1601. Although at the arraignment there is little debate about what happened during the uprising, and Essex never seeks to defend his actions, a surprising amount of court time is given over to establishing what was planned about taking the court. They're interested about premeditation. It's not about whose idea this was, but quite literally who held the pen to write down the plans. They spend a lot of time on this point. Prosecuting Essex in court, typically, was Francis Bacon. Bacon was keen to establish that the conspirators were not met together by constellation, just by fate, but purposely assembled upon summons and letters sent. He wanted material written evidence. And there wasn't any, because Essex had burned everything on the day of the rebellion. So what do you do when there is no written evidence? You have to then somehow create it. The conspirators had met, allegedly to plan the rebellion at Drury House, and Bacon put pressure on exactly how that conversation was minuted. Turning to Sir John Davis, he charged that in this consultation he was penna philosophi scribentis. You were clerk of that council table and wrote all, so you took the minutes. Sir John objected to this characterization. If with good manners I might, I would long since have interrupted you and saved you a great part of labour. For my intent is not to deny anything I have said or excuse that I have done, but to confess myself guilty of all and submit myself wholly to the Queen's mercy. That seems pretty sweeping, but in that you call me clerk of the council, let me tell you that Sir Charles Davis was writing. But his hand being bad, I was desirous to take the pen and write. But by and by the Earl said he would speed it himself. Therefore we being together so long and doing so little, the Earl went to his house and set down all with his own hand, which was formally set forth touching the taking and possessing of the court. So the pen should have been in Sir Charles Davis' hand, but since his hand was bad, it passes to Davis, but Davis writes too slowly, and so Essex takes the pen and sets down all with his own hand. So the culmination of this remarkable scribal incompetence is that the plan is penned by the Earl himself, and what's more, at his house and by himself. There's a way of making the written evidentiary responsibility cohere with the actual responsibility, if you like. No one else is involved in the end, it's only him, and we don't have it anyway. So we can say what we like about it. This insistent focus during the trial on written evidence and on who writes the written evidence provides the context for what I think is the oddest moment in the trial, a showdown between Essex and his erstwhile client, Francis Bacon. It must be pretty galling to be prosecuted by someone who's been your closest advisor for several years. The Earl suddenly interrupted Bacon, saying, "To answer Master Bacon's speech at once, I say thus much, and call forth Master Bacon against Master Bacon." He recounted how Master Bacon, being a daily courtier and having access to Her Majesty, which Essex didn't have for the last half year of his life, having access to Her Majesty, undertook to go to the Queen in my behalf. He drew a letter very artificially, which was subscribed with my name. And another letter was drawn to occasion the former, which other letter should come from his brother, Master Anthony Bacon, both which he should have shown unto the Queen. Gosnold brought them both to me, and in my letter he did plead for me as feelingly and pointed out my grievances as plainly as was possible. So what this is it's an exchange of letters. One goes from Anthony Bacon to Essex, the other one goes from Essex to Anthony Bacon. They are both composed, written by Francis Bacon. Essex signs the one with his name on, and presumably Brother Anthony signs the other one. Bacon then shows them to the Queen. And he's saying, and he's saying, you wrote these things. You're accusing me of having planned certain things during the period that these letters were written, but you were me. You were writing as me. Although one Essex sympathizer claimed that Bacon was so nipped on the head, and it did so quiet and amaze him that he had nothing to reply, most of the accounts of the trial show Bacon far from being embarrassed by this. Instead, he claimed that he had spent more hours to make him, Essex, a meet servant to Her Majesty than ever he deserved, and as for anything contained in those letters, it would not blush in the clearest light. This is an interpretation he maintained in his 1604 apology, where he insisted that he did draw with my lord's privity, and by his appointment, two letters, the one written from my brother, the other as an answer returned from my lord, both to be, by me, in secret manner showed to the Queen, which it pleased my lord Lee very strangely to mention at the bar. With my lord's privity, and by his appointment. Bacon is here claiming the letters were not only known to Essex, but formally commissioned by Essex, that he was only speaking with Essex's voice because he had been appointed to do so. It's a remarkable abdication of responsibility on Bacon's part, but perhaps a necessary one. And these letters survive in multiple copies. These were very widely circulated. And collecting witnesses of these letters for the second volume of the Francis Bacon, I found some with dates on, and they date from December 1600, which is only 5 weeks before the rebellion, the period when Bacon is meant not to have anything to do with Essex. So basically Essex is implicating Bacon at a very late stage in the run-up to the rebellion, and Bacon may well have wanted to distance himself from this. This Anthony Bacon-Essex exchange of letters captures in the crudest and most negative manner, if you like, the dynamics of the relationship where Bacon writes for Essex, as Essex, and through Essex. Essex is happy to sign the letter that came to him in Bacon's hand. He specifies that it was in Bacon's handwriting, the copy he received. But under pressure, he throws the letter back at Bacon, saying that it reflects Bacon's views, not necessarily his own. But Bacon is implicated beyond the disputable point of whether or not he holds the views signed off on by Essex. For in that exchange between Essex and Anthony Bacon, a third character emerges. These are extracts from the letter. My brother Francis Bacon, says Anthony, who is too wise, I think, to be abused, and too honest to abuse, though he be more reserved in all particulars than is needful. And he goes on. And then he says, I desire and hope to see my brother established by Her Majesty's favour, as I think him well worthy, for that he hath done and suffered. So this is Bacon's words, which will be shown to Elizabeth. So it's like Bacon talking to Elizabeth via Anthony to Essex. And then Essex writes back, for your brother, I hold him an honest gentleman, wish him all good, much the rather for your sake. Bacon here cannot help advancing himself in the middle of this exchange. In his closing words, Essex, or Francis Bacon, writes to Anthony, you know letters what hurt they have done me, and therefore make sure of this. Keep it safe, perhaps burn it. But as Francis Bacon wrote these words for the Earl, he had no intention of doing so. In his apology in 1604, he pointed out that these letters cannot now be retracted or altered, being by reason of my brother's or his lordship's servant's delivery long since come into diverse hands. It's not my fault, but these things are out in public now. I couldn't suppress them. But at the trial in 1601, Essex charges that Bacon had disseminated the letters through his own servants. So he'd put the letters out there and basically now was implicating Essex. It should be clear by now, or whatever the opposite of clear is, it should be clear by now that the critical debate between Paul Hammer and Brian Vickers is in fact rehearsing the exchange in the courtroom that day between Essex and Francis Bacon, although each party is now keen to claim the works written by Bacon for and as Essex. The impasse of the modern debate replays the tension in the original heated exchange, and in so doing, I think, reminds us that in order to understand Bacon's intellectual project, we need to look further than his own letters. Thank you.